Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So as we come out of the COVID crisis sometime, all countries face the same issue. You've got lots of people out of work, you've got businesses with heavy loans, and governments that believe they have to do something to claw back their deficits. Wouldn't it be easier if there was some sort of coordinated approach? Well, Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the State for the Treasury in the United States, seems to think so. That's why she is looking for a coordinated approach when it comes to corporate tax. A complete reversal of the Trump approach, in other words. So his idea was drop corporate tax to try and bring businesses back to the United States. So will the Janet Yellen approach work? Is it time for countries to work together rather than compete against each other when it comes to fiscal policy? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So, Steve, Janet Yellen wants other countries to push up their corporate tax rates so they are on a par with the US, basically. I think what she's realized is if they push up the corporate tax rate in America, then that'll be a disincentive, hate that word, for people to stay in America, and they might go somewhere else where the corporate tax rate is cheaper. We've also got, at the same time, the IMF wants countries to tax the rich to help narrow the rich-poor gap in developed nations. So we'll look at that as well. But look, Janet Yellen, first of all, wants everyone to have a corporate tax rate of 28%, which is what the United States wants to move to. That is going to be very bad news for Ireland. Is there where the, you know, the only reason that people are moving to Ireland, digital companies in particular, placing their European headquarters there, because their corporate tax rate is 12.5%. Is there any chance at all that Janet Yellen's going to get a wish?
I can't see any, unfortunately. I mean, there are things about it that I don't like. One of the huge elements of the modern financial system is the extent to which corporations can play one jurisdiction off against another because of differences in tax rates. And sometimes it's just because, you know, they'll lobby a country like Ireland to slash its tax rate to virtually zero to encourage corporations to move there. But they also use what's called transfer pricing. And I remember talking to a software engineer back in the 80s, back when I used to work in computers, about him working for a multinational. I've forgotten which one it was, but an American corporation, and he was based in Sydney. And he told me that he'd regularly make a telephone call to the developers of the code they were using inside the company in the States, and then he found out the accountant became a good friend, and turned out that each telephone call was billed at $10,000 the tax rate was lower in America. So a 10-minute call cost the Australian company $10,000 and transferred, you know, $10,000 worth of profit effectively across to the American enterprise where they could pay a lower rate of corporate tax.
Yeah, and that is the problem, isn't it? And it's become even harder now in this digital world, because what do you do if you sell software and the tax rate is lower in the United States or higher in the United States? You basically say, well, okay, where are we going to put all our development costs to minimize the amount of tax that we have to pay? So we make a loss in some countries because the cost of that software, creating the software, has been so high. It's so easy in this day and age to work around it. But you'd have to, if you were to have a standard rate, every country would have to be party to it. And there's no incentive for them to do that if the alternative is where you can get some tax revenue that you weren't going to get before.
Yeah, though the Americans have got form here in terms of forcing people into using their system. One thing I've been warned by friends quite regularly is never get a green card for America, because as soon as you end up on the American tax system, they chase you for your taxable income no matter where you earn it in the world. And because there's
such a case in point is my wife, who's never, when she was a kid, she was in America. Her dad was American. She's got an American passport. She has to file an American tax return. every year, even though she's not been to America, doesn't earn any money in America, she still has to file the tax returns. I mean, she doesn't have to pay tax because it gets well, she would have if she was in a low taxing country, but because she's in the UK, that doesn't happen. And it's you've got to file 5 years worth. We're going through this now, so she can renounce her American citizenship, because we're worried that if our house reaches a certain value, America can grab the capital gains. They're bastards.
Yeah, I know they are. So there's one reason I don't mind seeing Janet Yellen fail on this one, even though I'd like to see uniform tax rates, or at least some sort of system that makes it impossible for corporations to evade the tax burden. Because as we know, like we've been talking from a modern monetary theory point of view, it's not the tax that provides the revenue for the government. But if you have a need to take excess money out of the circulation that's been created by a government deficit, then the burden of that falls entirely on the working class and the middle class. If you have the capacity for corporations to evade tax, which they manifestly have that capability in ways that we and I don't.
But it also takes out of the hands of the governments the ability for them to, take control. You know, we left, it's ironic, we went down this road. I mean, we left the EU because we wanted to take back control. This would mean, you know, we'd be all pandering to America, which is potentially even worse, isn't it? Particularly, I mean, you know, some people might want to play with their corporate tax to achieve other aims. Like China, for example, has got a 25% tax rate, but they lower it to 15% for some sectors that they like to encourage and see develop. I mean, you would get a bun fight, wouldn't you, if you tried to take that away from
them?
Yeah,
and this is, the whole idea that you can have uniformity is not going to work. It can be enforced in an organization like the European Union, but that's, one of my favorite botched jobs on the planet. And even there, of course, Ireland gets away with a lower tax rate than the remainder of the European Union does. So
How do they pull that off, I wonder?
I can't quote chapter and verse on it, but there have been some pretty big fights with the European Union for them to hang on to it, largely because they were effectively arguing they were like developing country status within the European Union compared to France and Germany. So they could get away with it to some extent by political lobbying inside the European Union. But overall, it's, the tax system is, it's the easiest way to provoke somebody into being right-wing is to bring up taxing. And that certainly happens with the whole idea of corporations avoiding tax. That makes you left-wing, but governments trying to impose tax on you makes you right-wing. You have to have a way of taking money out of circulation. Because if the government simply spent everything and didn't take any back, then you'd have an enormous increase in the money supply. But taxation is looking like a less, far away from the best way of doing that.
Yeah. And corporate tax in particular. I mean, income tax perhaps more. I mean, and that is, the other point as well. If the corporate tax on its own is to try and get some sort of uniformity so that companies can't move profit centers around the planet. You can always, on the other side, reduce income tax to encourage executives to base themselves in your country. If you have to adhere to that 28% rule, you'll say, okay, well, we'll reduce our top level of income tax so companies will come here and pay the tax because they know they're going to pay less income tax for the top individuals. And if you try and if you say, well, okay, let's try and standardize that as well, then you really are at the stage where America is determining, fiscal policies of every country in the world, which they might quite like, I suspect.
Yeah, but to some extent, you can get away with that because most of the economic cycles are relatively synchronized around the planet, but again, it's showing one of the failings of a globalized system. When you globalize, institutions that can straddle the globe are going to do better than those that can't. And you and I can't straddle the globe; we're individuals, but corporations can, and thereby you get this competition between different governments to attract the corporations to base themselves locally, and all this crazy stuff comes about tax. And now, of course, the major champions of globalization, the Americans and the Washington Consensus, are trying to reverse the impact.
There must be something you could do, though. So I'm looking at the Economist, some numbers in The Economist recently. They say the big five in Silicon Valley pay $220 billion, that's about £159 billion, in cash taxes in the past decade. and that represents just 16% of their pre-tax profits. So couldn't you say, okay, I don't know how you divvy it up on a country-by-country basis, but if you are paying below a certain percentage in tax, let's say call it 25%. Well, no, let's call it 28%, which is what they want to aim for. If you're paying less than 28% over, say, 10 years, then, you know, I'm sure you've got a million and one excuses that a lot of that was because you were putting money into redeploying it back into the company for growth. But let's say it's over 10 years, and let's wipe out the last couple of years where you might have been, it might have been investment. But over a 10-year period, you've got to pay that difference between that 16% and 28%. And yes, let's make it that you pay it based on where the sales are, which is the other thing that Janet Yellen's been trying to say is, you know,
that, that's really more interesting to me than the idea of uniform tax rates, because.
Yeah.
Speaking decades, I think it was actually 3 decades ago, I went for a holiday to the Cayman Islands with my then wife, you know, a diving holiday. And one thing I wanted to check out was the building out of which operated, I think, believe, News Corporation and 30 other major multinational companies. And of course, it was a two-story whitewashed building with brass plaques at the front and nobody home. But that was where News Corporation and numerous other companies record their major profits. And it's all by creative accounting. They have virtually no sales in the Cayman Islands, but because of the low tax rates, that's where they record their profits.
Yeah, well, you know, the Cayman Islands, even, you know, the Isle of Man, the Channel Islands, Monaco, there's lots of them, aren't there? And I wonder how they would go with this this corporate tax idea. But yes, the idea that you actually shift it to where the sales are happening sounds like a good idea. And we've got everyone around the world is trying to impose some sort of, in an ad hoc fashion, some sort of tax on some digital tax or tax on digital companies. This would be the way to do it, wouldn't it? But then the companies are going to say, well, we can't just be based on sales because, you know, the point I made earlier, most of our production costs are back in the United States, for example.
Yeah, I think ultimately I come down to, well, where sales, but not just sales. If you think about sales, I mean, the company might make their sales internationally and have their costs back in America. But the costs themselves, in the sense, are a sale by the people that are selling inputs to them, including their workers. So if you tax on sales, then it's very, very hard to fudge the results. And if it's a flat rate, you don't have even be much, much lower rate than if you tax every transaction rather than taxing the value added in each transaction, which is the idea of goods and services tax and value added taxes. Tax every transaction at a low rate, no matter where it happens. That may be a more effective way of getting money out of circulation than income tax or tax on corporate profits.
But there's, I mean, different products obviously have different cost bases. So if you're taxing the same amount, so software, once you've sunk the cost, it's just a cost of sale, isn't it? Whereas if you're building bridges, it's a manufacturing process. You've got very heavy costs. So there's got to be something that relates to the margins of the business. But I'm sure you can still do that. It's a question of whether you're actually seeing your overseas sales as incremental to your US-based sales, or whether you're actually seeing it all as part and parcel of the one product. And of course, you don't see it as incremental, but it's treated as that, isn't it? So you say, well, okay, we produce a software, we employ a lot of people in the United States, and we make a certain number of sales in the United States, and we pay tax on the profit we make after all those heavy costs have come out of it. And then all the additional sales we make, oh, well, that's just icing on the cake that, you know, we managed to sell it overseas, even though maybe 75 or 80% of your sales are from overseas. So you actually made that software not just for America, if you're being honest. You made that software for the world, and therefore you should apportion the cost and the revenue according to where it's consumed, which would make a great deal of sense.
Yeah, but then again, you'd be paying taxes, your American corporation would be paying taxes in the UK for its UK sales, which is what I think should happen. It's one of these absolute minefields with the capacity of corporations to relocate their costs and to use creative accounting to pretend their profits are made in tax havens and so on. And it's one of those things which again makes me pine for a genuine international order like Keynes was pushing for with the Bancor, because you could have effectively controlled that at the national level through the Bancor system. imposing the penalties you're talking about on countries that offer low tax breaks and so on, and equalise that way. And we simply don't have that opportunity with the international system we have.
But who would be the controlling body on that? That would be a very powerful body indeed, wouldn't it? I mean, almost like a world government, Steve.
Well, that's what the International Monetary Fund was supposed to be, that original clearinghouse that Keynes was arguing for. But again, you would have had one country, one vote type operations at the international level. I'm not actually sure what Keynes had on that front, whether you had one country, one vote, or you had votes by the scale of the size of the economy, which would still give America the biggest vote. But a combination of the two in that sense, one vote for size and one vote for existence, something of that nature, to balance it out. But we don't have that system, and therefore the best that Janet Yellen can hope to do is the jawboning they're doing now. What amuses me is, what will the Americans do when this jawboning fails? What will be their next tactic?
They will lower their... lower their corporate tax back to where it was, obviously. Also, she's only doing it, isn't she? So she can push up the rates without losing business. That's why she's using it as a sales technique, isn't she? I think to say, we want to push up corporate taxes, but hey, look, the rest of the world is with us as well. We're not alone on this. It's a political move, really, isn't it?
It is, but this is one thing which COVID might have an impact on as well, because we're going to see, I think, in the aftermath of COVID, and also with the impact of climate change and the damage we've got to the long supply chains we have these days, I think a lot of production is going to move back to the country of origin. And in that situation, that'll simplify Yellen's problem. It won't make capitalism any more viable, because it'll be ecological pressures that are damaging profits and damaging the supply line that are the motive. But it'll make this issue of differential tax rates less of an issue if production goes back to being more national-based than globalised.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. There was a UK company that listed on the NASDAQ or is about to, and I think it did actually last week, it makes electric buses and electric vehicles. And part of their push is for micro-manufacturing. So, in other words, smaller factories. And their argument is, I think, that the cost of machinery used to be, you needed a lot of machinery to get the economies of scale. Now the cost of machinery has come down so much that you can have machines to produce smaller amounts in more locations. Therefore, your cost of distribution goes down because you have micro-manufacturing plants. So rather than having one factory turning out 1,000 vehicles, why not have 10 factories turning out 100 vehicles, which are closer to their destination? That would be nice to see if that was the way the world went.
Well, yeah, but that again comes down to whether you can you're trading off transportation costs for products on one side against economies of scale for the factory on the other. And,
Their point is the economies of scale are coming down so much. So the economies of scale are actually in the manufacturing of the equipment that makes these things. Maybe the cost of making 10 smaller machines isn't that much more than the cost of making one big machine. Perhaps technology's moved on to that.
A bit of a skeptic there. We've been reading up on Tesla's new rig, which is going to pump out the structure of the Cybertruck, and that is a press which has to press the same stainless steel they're using on the SpaceX rockets, which is incredibly hard, flexible but hard. And that press has a weight of 8,000 tons. If you made it 800,
too many of those.
If you made it 800 tons, it wouldn't even bend the metal. That's why I think economies of scale are still going to rule for large scale manufacturing, particularly saying things like computer chips as well. I mean, the whole idea that you can have, there is some possibility with 3D printing and so on. Maybe in that case, you can reduce your capital costs in some elements. But
you just argued against yourself then. Saying that things need to be more centralised. There we are. You see, taking you around a full circuit there. Let's look at the IMF. You mentioned the IMF. I constantly wonder what it is they actually do, apart from give out loans. And it's not actually them giving out loans half the time. It's their member countries giving it to people who need it. The IMF said this last week, they had the audacity, really, to say that those who've done well out of COVID-19 should be paying more tax. They're not talking about countries, they're talking about individuals. So they're saying governments around the world, particularly wealthy countries, should be taxing the rich more to compensate those who've done less well. They just mean not those less well in other countries, just in their own country. So Vitor Gaspar, who's the IMF's head of fiscal affairs, was interviewed by the FT, and he said, yeah, there's been a rise in inequality during the pandemic as younger and poorer people have suffered the most because they're at greater risk of losing their jobs and their incomes. So it's not a decree from the IMF, just them stating the bleeding obvious that they should perhaps tax the wealthy a bit more, if you know, unless we go down the modern monetary theory road. But this is the conventional thinking that governments only have money if they tax people to get it. He says a temporary tax on the highest wages for a period would solve or help solve the problem anyway, saying this is what Germany did with their solidarity tax after reunification. Well, yeah. Tax the rich a bit more. It's not going to. It's only going to perhaps help in countries like the UK or the US, perhaps. But it's not going to have much impact, is it? It's certainly not going to, you know, create those jobs for those people.
No, and well, again, the argument for taxation is a redistribution one rather than a revenue for the government one. But
and that's not the argument he's using. Because he's IMF's head of fiscal affairs. That's the way he thinks.
It's quite amusing for me to hear this stuff coming out of the IMF and the World Bank and the American government and so on, because for the last 30 or 40 years, they were lobbying for a world with minimal regulation, minimal tax rates, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they've got that world and they want out.
Yeah, well, as I say, having the audacity to suggest this. But I mean, even this is ignoring the bigger issue, which the IMF, which we'll come on to, which is, you know, what about the poor countries that really do need help? But just that question about taxing the rich, even if you were looking at as a redistribution exercise is one thing. But if you were looking at it, if you were following that, you know, the thinking that this guy, what's his name, Vitor Gaspar, what he's thinking is that, you know, you can use it to raise money to help pay the poor. But, well, you know, top rate of tax in the UK is 45% if you earn over £150,000. But only 481,000 people paid that in last year's figures out of 32.3 million taxpayers. So if you were to push that 45% up to 50%, and let's say the average income in that top bracket was £250,000, and you introduced a 50% tax at, say, £200,000, then you've got 481,000 people paying an extra 5% on £50,000. That's £1.2 billion to make. Now, the government rakes in about £820 billion in tax. So actually, what you're talking about is an extra 0.1%. I mean, it's not going to make a big difference, is it?
No. The main thing I want to see we get over in terms of everything about the government is the idea of the government needing to tax in order to spend. Get rid of that and get rid of the austerity rather than the redistribution effects of taxation. And it's, again, that's one reason why I don't think it's so easy for the wealthy to hide their tax, to hide their income, to reduce their tax levels. It's not possible for the poor to do it. So all these schemes, and in fact, what you do by bringing in higher tax rates to some extent is encourage more of that evasion. I want to see some equalization some higher tax rates for higher income levels. But there's a point at which the politics it generates can undermine everything else you're trying to achieve. And that's, I think that was certainly was happening back when you had the high, the sort of 90% tax rates, marginal tax rates back in the 60s. That actually, to some extent, fed the growth of the legal and power side of the wealthy to fight and bring down that level of taxation. So you did it for left-wing reasons and got a right-wing outcome.
Yeah, unfortunately. And that was the case in the United States as well, wasn't it? They had very high taxes at that time as well. It wasn't just, communist states like the UK, for example, or socialist states, I should say. So should there be should Janet Yellen also be pushing to try and get some sort of agreement on income tax then around the world? I mean, it would be. I'm surprised the EU hasn't got it yet. I'm sure they're heading that way because there's a huge difference. So the top bracket for income tax in the United States, for example, is 37%. You only do that when you earn $500,000. Most people are on 24% or less, so they pay much less tax than they do in the UK. You can't really look at corporate tax without looking at income tax, can you, if you're trying to balance things out around the world?
No, you can't. But again, I think this is an interesting, futile exercise. I'm just intrigued to see what the response is to Yellen's attempt to do it. And whether the Americans get heavy-handed and whether they try to enforce it. I think that's, given the fact that I don't think it's going to happen, it's more how the Americans respond to it not happening that I'm interested in rather than the actual proposal.
Right. And the real issue, I mean, if all of this is because we are coming into out of a world that's been riddled with COVID, I'm not quite sure how quickly we're going to come out of that world, and we want to use, we've spent a lot of money and we need to make sure we're looking after the poor, then the real issue actually surely is, I mean, okay, it is the poor people in rich countries, although let's hope that their jobs will come back and it'll just be a relatively temporary blip for those people. The real issue is the poor countries, isn't it? Those developing countries that have racked up an enormous amount of debt, probably in US dollars, when their balance of trade has taken a momentous hit because there's been less demand for whatever it is that they might export, they've got US debts that they can't afford to pay. Probably they owe it to the IMF or to an IMF member country. What's the IMF going to do about that?
Yeah, well, that's where I've seen the Debt Jubilee campaign getting a lot stronger, at least on Twitter, arguing that we should be actually having more debt write-offs, and that, again, that was what Ann Pettifor was involved in organizing back in 2000 with the Jubilee Year debt campaign back then. And I think we'll need the same thing in the aftermath to COVID. I think if you can, again, this is the same reason I argue for a modern debt jubilee at the national level. It's cut off the cash flow of so many, not just people, as you're saying now, but countries as well. So Thailand, for example, has had about a 20% fall in its GDP courtesy of the tourism industry being hacked by COVID. And if it did have IMF debt, and I sincerely hope that it doesn't, then it would be in an even harder position after that, trying to pay back with a rundown, with its revenue source run down by the impact of COVID on tourism.
Yeah. Well, because of course the first thing the IMF do if they give you a loan is say, well, okay, you've got to restructure. Yeah, you've got to get public spending down, which obviously makes things worse. Which is, and it's interesting, isn't it? The IMF would be doing that and saying that to countries, whereas the United States, where the IMF is based, is doing the exact opposite and is borrowing it's creating money really to spend big. So one rule for one and another rule for everyone else.
Yeah, well, it's a rule when you don't produce the American dollar, and that's if you're running an import, if you have a trade deficit, and then you've got to be importing goods which you've got to pay for in American dollars, then that pushes those countries into having to issue American dollar debt, and then they're on the IMF treadmill. So, like I know from my friends in Indonesia, after the 1997 Asian financial crisis, that the IMF was persona non grata in Indonesia, and I believe it's still in the same situation. So that's one form of money that people don't want to have in their pockets.
But nobody wants these countries to struggle because they are either selling to them or buying from them. So taking Thailand, for example, there would be Americans and Europeans who want to go to Thailand on holiday. There will also be companies that have invested big in the tourist industry in Thailand or in other businesses in Thailand. They don't want to see the country struggle. They want to see it prosper, but I guess they want to do that with a loan that they expect they're going to get paid back at some point. They don't want to hand the money over. But how would a debt jubilee work? Would it be just for those countries that are struggling, or would you say, let's have it's only money. everyone's in debt. Let's find a level. Let's just wipe it all. You know, what was $1 trillion debt is now zero debt. Just take $1 trillion off the bottom line in every country in the world.
Well, actually, I'm thinking better ask Ann Pettifor that question rather than me, because Ann has actually done that at the national level. My proposal is all about using a capacity of a currency-creating government to use its currency-creating capability to cancel credit-based money and replace it with fiat-based money. And that, relatively speaking, is quite an easy proposal. But if you're talking about doing it at an international level, then you have countries that owe in American dollars. Who do they owe the money to? If they owe it to the American government, then it's no particular problem because the American government creates its own American dollars. If it owes to corporations, it owes to banks and so on, then if you have that debt written off, then you have potential catastrophic effects on the balance sheets of banks. So a lot of it was actually just overseas aid money that was that had been given as loans rather than as grants, and you're expected to pay the loans back. And that form of country-to-country non-largesse, I think, can easily be cancelled. It just means a small increase in the effective deficit for those countries in their own currencies.
Everything we've been talking about today really is almost like a great reset, isn't it? It's, to what extent do we want autonomy, and to what extent do we need, if we were to start again, and this seems like a good point to start again, doesn't it? Obviously, you've got to make sure that, people are not having their wealth destroyed too much. But if we were to start again, what are the new rules for the road? Do we actually have more coordination between countries on fiscal policy? Well, look, we got out of the EU for precisely that reason. We wanted more autonomy. We didn't want another country or another group of countries telling us what our tax rate should be or how much we can spend on state aid and all that sort of stuff. Because that's the next thing that naturally follows, isn't it? When you start saying, well, okay, let's make sure we've all got the same amount of corporate tax, then you so that it's the same around the world, so it's a level playing field. Then you start saying, but hang on a second, you're not going to get around this by giving state aid to certain industries to compensate them for the fact that their corporate tax is higher, to try and get them to move into your country. The rules, you're just going to have a massive, almost like a free trade agreement for the world, which is just going to be pages long.
Pages? I think it's books long.
Hundreds of thousands of pages.
It's a non-starter. I mean, I'm certainly hoping it will be a non-starter. And, of course, that's a large part of what happens when you do have an international group like that, then you do seed your capacity to make different forms of policy, and the policy gets moved further away from the community rather than closer to it. And this, overall, this is one of the reasons we have national currencies and national governments. Mm. And to take it to the supranational level and take away that capacity to have some role, at least, in determining your own future, that's... I can understand the negative reactions to that.
Well, it is world government stuff, isn't it? Fundamentally.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're in for that because of what we've done to the... We're going to have to think at the global level, courtesy of what we've gone to the globe. At some point, the globe's not going to give it two hoots about the situation of some bipedal monkeys versus other bipedal monkeys on the planet. That's going to worry about the actual biosphere in the Toto, and we're going to be forced to backtrack for the impact that we've had on the global ecology. We haven't quite got there yet, and these proposals have got nothing to do with that, so I'm happy to knock them down.
Do you know what? Whenever I've watched one of those sort of post-apocalyptic movies where there is somebody who's running the world, it is either sort of like an action hero, all very muscly, or it's someone who looks exactly like Joe Biden, sort of like an elderly bloke. So maybe that's it. Maybe he's going to be the new world leader. We'll see. Anyway, all right, very good. Look, next week, another topic, and I want to talk about the planet, actually, funny enough. I mean, Bill Gates is talking about a green premium. We'll explore that idea a bit more next week. But for now, great to talk, Steve.
Okay.
By the way, if you've emailed in your suggestions about things you'd like us to talk about or questions you'd like to answer, sorry we haven't got to them yet. We will do it in a couple of weeks. We've got a few of them, so we'll work our way through those. That's it for this week, though. I'm Phil Dobby, back with Steve next week. Thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favourite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.